Hyperion to a satyr.
Welcome to the second episode of Hyperion to a Satyr, the Fire and Water Podcast Network's Hamlet podcast. I'm your host, Siskoid, your guide on a scene-by-scene deep dive look at Shakespeare's masterwork through the lens of not only the text, but many film, television, comics, and even music adaptations. As the chronology dictates, today we're talking about Act 1, Scene 2, but one of the challenges of doing a project like this is that some scenes are so long, I've decided to cut them down into pieces for both theme and manageability. Act 1, Scene 2 will be split into three. The wedding banquet, everything before Hamlet is named, and in future episodes we'll have Enter Hamlet, which goes through the end of his speech, and then ghost stories from Horatio's entrance to the end of the scene. Today we only look at that first section, holding off Hamlet's first lines until the next episode. Versions of the play that have done away with scene one will usually start with the banquet. How does that affect our understanding of the play? Well, that's a question we're sure to ask. But also, this is the introduction of a number of important characters. Claudius, Gertrude, Polonius, and Laertes. So I expect to spend some time discussing casting. It should also be our introduction to the interior of Elsinore, which, of course, affects staging. But let's talk about the text before doing anything else. Again, I won't read the entire thing, but I will highlight lines I think are interesting. The scene starts just after Claudius's and Gertrude's wedding ceremony, and the king is addressing the guests, which include, according to stage directions, Hamlet, Polonius, Laertes, Voltimand, Cornelius, as well as lords in attendance. Claudius is a practical man who presents himself as someone who gets on with things. Thinks on his brother with grief, but remembers himself too. This is an important point to make about the character, not only because he uses his pragmatism to convince the court of his ascendance to the throne, and one could imagine a pre-Hamlet scene in which he used this brand of logic to explain why he'd make a better king than Hamlet Jr., but because it may well be how he could follow through on a fratricide. It also makes him the perfect nemesis for Hamlet, with an attitude that stands in stark opposition to the lead's excessively intellectual ambivalence. Claudius is king because he acts. Hamlet isn't because he doesn't. At the end of the speech, he gives Voltimand and Cornelius, two ambassadors, a message of peace to bring the king of Norway. If scene one was slashed in any great measure, then so will this speech, which pertains to the outside world. It may still work to set up Fortinbras for the end, but seems completely useless without the Norwegian subplot. In the full play, it sets up Claudius's arrogance and the eventual loss of what his brother had won. At the end of the section we're studying, he also calls on Laertes, his chief advisor's son, and gives him a nice send-off to France. It's noteworthy that Claudius should address Laertes' wishes before those of Hamlet. Hamlet may be next in line, but Claudius plainly puts Laertes first. This opposes Laertes and Hamlet from their first shared scene, and this will obviously carry through to the end, with Claudius acting as adoptive father to Laertes. In effect, Hamlet and Laertes are brothers, both related to the king, one by blood and the other by politics. Polonius, and thus his family, were apparently better connected to Claudius than to Hamlet Sr., who, being gone to the wars, may not have been so well attended, and has been promoted to a place of influence in this new regime. By giving Laertes favor here, Claudius shows his true colors as a political animal first. The irony, of course, is that had Polonius been more patient and thrown his support in with the filial rites, his daughter might well have become queen. Another point I'd like to make about the Hamlet-Laertes rivalry is that while Hamlet studies in nearby Wittenberg, Laertes spends his time in France. That Claudius shows preference to a son that has been corrupted by another country, in effect prefers the Frenchman to the Dane, speaks to the weakened state he is now the head of. The country has been usurped by a pretender who does not even love it, but would corrupt it just as a debauched country has corrupted Laertes. This isn't my opinion of France, but it is Polonius's, if we go by later scenes where he treats his son's soul as being in mortal danger over there. A further contrast between Wittenberg and France is that Wittenberg wasn't just a university town, but in Shakespeare's day was better known as the home of Martin Luther and the Reformation. So in the context of our discussion about the Christian-pagan schism, it perhaps explains why Hamlet comes across as more Christian, even prudish, than the rest of Danish nobility. Only Hamlet considers the wedding to be incestuous. He gives an almost Puritan anti-wassail speech. He won't kill Claudius while the king is praying because he fears Claudius will go to heaven. But Laertes would kill Hamlet in a church. Afterlife be damned. So those are just a few examples, but it might even explain Hamlet's reluctance to act before all the information is in, the struggle of the prince trying to be Christian in a pagan, or at least a not very devout, court, in a situation where rash, unchristian behavior might nevertheless be called for. So, as usual, we start with Branagh's uncut version. He sets the banquet in the most important set of the film, the Hall of Mirrors. This long ballroom is bright, where Elsinore is often portrayed as dank, and each of its mirrors is a door, lending a reflective quality to various spying scenes, as we'll eventually see. Claudius, played by the always excellent Derek Jacobi, fits into this world seamlessly. His bright red military uniform and bristly bleached hair allow him to revel in this kind of opulence. Not only is his red the color of blood, the blood that is on his hands, but it also identifies him as a preening peacock, full of self-love. His red contrasts Hamlet's black. He is most definitely not in mourning, but rather celebrating his brother's death. An important bit of staging here. Claudius' opening speech is made in front of a large audience. This is his first speech as king, having taken the previous king's queen as his own. A political move that requires a certain measure of justification. Claudius excels at what today we would call spin, as he is a creature of appearances. A false king, in power under false pretenses, everything looks gorgeous, although we know Denmark is diseased. This is how he uses his charisma. And Jacobi's performance is a sympathetic one. The villain does not reveal himself for quite some time, and you want to believe him in this early scene. Jacobi has also chosen to make his Claudius truly be in love with Gertrude, which the full text supports. Pretty easy, you might say, since Gertrude is played by Julie Christie, a striking woman, and whose blood may not be as tame as Hamlet would have it. Of course, he makes it plain that this would never have happened if the court had not freely gone with this affair along. So the whole state is complicit in this usurped throne, incestuous bond. And so it is doomed along with Claudius himself. Cue Fortinbras later. Now, speaking of Fortinbras, in an often cut bit, Claudius deals with him in his particular idiom, with dramatic flair and arrogance. Listen to him talk about Norway's prince.
Young Fortinbras. Owning a weak supposal of our worth, or thinking by our late dear brother's death our state to be disjoint and out of frame, colleagued with the dream of his advantage, he hath not failed to pester us with message, importing the surrender of those lands lost by his father with all bonds of law to our most valiant brother. So much for him.
There he rips up the news item. The court eats it up. Claudius is media savvy, but as everyone else's unease has taught us, he may not actually be up to the challenge of defending Denmark. So he dismisses the threat posed by Fortinbras, misjudging the entire situation. I've noted Claudius's military dress, but all the men in the court wear military uniforms. In this version of the play, war is very much on everyone's minds. Denmark is a military state, and Fortinbras's movements are part of the larger campaign Hamlet Sr. took part in. And then comes Laertes. Remember, Hamlet is last and least on Claudius's agenda. Played here by Michael Maloney, who is a member of Branagh's regular players. Maloney always gives a good performance, though I've always thought of his Laertes as a bit wishy-washy. Maybe it's the haircut. In any case, we don't get a great sense of his character here, nor of Richard Brier's Polonius or Kate Winslet's Ophelia, who's also present, except that they seem to be very nice people. In fact, if we didn't know any better, this Denmark would seem to be a nice enough place. The new king has judged the mood of the country well and appears both sympathetic to their loss and aware of what needs to be done for political stability. The presence of civilians on the balcony in this scene and the way everything is handled publicly makes it look like an open government, not an authoritarian regime. How will people react when Hamlet starts acting up? This sets up a Denmark that is decidedly on the side of Claudius. Does it contribute to Hamlet's doubts and delays? Now, Olivier's most intriguing contribution to the wedding banquet in 1948 is actually the transition leading into it. The camera, which you'll remember, is roving through Elsinore. Is it God? Is it the ghost? Third person omniscient? The camera is looking for the wedding party and lands on an empty bed. Now, this lends credence to the theory that the camera is actually the ghost's point of view, as driven by jealousy, it takes a peek into the adulterous bedchamber. The banquet itself is a much more stately affair, with everyone pretty much sitting around and talking. Claudius is a particular disappointment for me. Basil Sidney is stiff in both posture and delivery. Some of the blame should go to the costumes. They're gaudy rather than rich. And Claudius's wide shoulders, tights combo is particularly ludicrous to our eyes today. The court certainly contrasts with Hamlet's simple black attire in this, perhaps symbolic of Denmark's complicity in Claudius's putsch, audible in this version as they mutter in agreement a number of times throughout the speech. Everyone's getting rich in this new regime, the sense I get. Unfortunately, Sidney doesn't play Claudius sympathetically, which is not uncommon, really, and it makes him more transparent as the villain. He's smug and self-satisfied, but a glimmer of hope exists in his relationship to Gertrude. Does he actually love her? His sighs denote lust, at the very least, for sure. He's helped along by a rather young Gertrude, though I think she just barely pulls it off. Eileen Hurley here is 11 years younger than Olivier, who plays her son. So bizarre casting, you might say, but useful in establishing one of those Freudian through lines that I dislike so much. Still, the younger the Gertrude, the more sexual tension can be drawn from their Oedipal relationship. Hurley would return to the role more mature, one would think. In Richard Burton's version, I've not seen it. The other characters we meet here are Terence Morgan's young and enthusiastic Laertes, who should seem much changed when he returns from France with revenge in his heart, because one would hardly believe this fresh, naive face would be credible talking about cutting Hamlet's throat in a church. The success of the character will hinge on Morgan's ability to sell his moral downfall. His father, Polonius, is played as a typical kindly old man by Felix Aylmer. Just as in scene one, all mention of Fortinbras, Norway, and the world at large has been expunged, so Claudius doesn't get to show off, I'll unkindly say mercifully here, and reduces this courtly meeting to the essential family affairs of the day. The BBC's version of Claudius is famously played by Patrick Stewart, clearly having fun in his bouffant toupee. It's a performance that initially disappointed me, though I'm ready to revisit and reevaluate it now. This Claudius is not on as solid a footing politically as some others, which I now realize is straight from the text. This revelation comes from the performances of Cornelius and Voltemand, the envoys to Norway, who are very serious about their duty, so much so, they appear to be driven only by duty. Granted, they have very few lines in this scene, and duty is all they have to play, but their joylessness borders on resentment, fear, or resignation, maybe. Claudius may have Polonius in his corner, but surely he hasn't replaced everyone at court. Can he trust the men who were loyal to his brother? But suddenly, there's a warning in the following words.
Giving to you no further personal power to business with the king, more than the scope of these dilated articles allow.
And defensiveness in
we doubted nothing.
Claudius is just a little bit paranoid, still cajoling the enemies that surround him. He's guilty of something. Laertes' attitude follows suit. When he's called to appear, he seems puzzled and afraid, thus the dread lord line. He looks to his father, unsure of what to do. What is going through his mind here? Like everyone else in this court, he doesn't know if he can trust the situation. Maybe he was even loyal to the old king. Is he in a hurry to return to France because he doesn't like this new regime? Certainly, he was a friend of Hamlet's and has certain loyalties to him. It probably isn't proper for Claudius to give Laertes an audience before he gives one to Hamlet, switching sons, as we've previously discussed. So Laertes is caught unawares. He's visibly embarrassed by the event. So as he leaves the court, he gives Hamlet a friendly and apologetic nod. He has reason to. Not only is he given audience first, but Claudius is unusually, tactile with him. So once he's done with Laertes, who is played by David Robb, I should mention, Claudius walks to the throne and away from Hamlet as he addresses him, underscoring the distance between them after his unbearably inappropriate closeness with Laertes. In this version, Hamlet is clearly visible on stage throughout the wedding banquet, rather than revealed, as he often is, on his first line. And he's active as well, standing behind his mother, played by the great Claire Bloom, he seems to have given her away in marriage. So that's right. He also went freely with this affair along, if this interpretation is correct. But then the prince applauds sarcastically. So Jacoby's Hamlet is openly disrespectful and scornful of his uncle from the first, which helps sell the idea that Claudius's reign holds by a thread. With Claudius and Gertrude standing so far apart, the wedding appears to be a stately affair and more than ever a political move. Perhaps Claudius loves her, but he's certainly not showing his weakness in this public arena. Of Gertrude and Eric Porter's Polonius, interestingly younger and stouter than most actors cast in this role, I shall have cause to speak later, when they get more lines. Jump 10 years to 1990, and we have Zeffirelli, who likes to play fast and loose with the play's scene structure, upending certain lines, changing the sequence of scenes around, and turning single scenes into multiple ones. Act 1, Scene 2, which I've split into 3, Zeffirelli splits into 5, not to mention one of its lines thrown into the prologue. The overall effect is to stretch the timeline of events. They don't all occur at the same event, but are instead spread over a vague period of time. At the same time, Zeffirelli reduces many lines to their barest essentials, which of course changes our reading of the play. The first sequence is, as traditional, the wedding banquet before the court. The throne room is huge, a real seat of power, and the royals rather far from their attendees. Though Claudia speaks, it is Gertrude we watch, for signs of affection. Glenn Close plays her as a little nervous, but definitely content. Again, this version of the play intimates that the two have had an affair prior to Hamlet Sr.'s death, or that at least she knows she jumped beds rather quickly after his passing. So she's nervous to see if the court will agree, or perhaps she's afraid of the gossip. Ian Holmes' Polonius is rather austere here and doesn't get a line, but his demeanor nonetheless reveals something about him and the situation. He's the one who stands in front of the court and moves them to rise when the speech is over. He's very much the one pulling the political strings, and because he controls the court, there's the inference that the court needs to be controlled. Are the courtiers easy to manipulate? Or maybe even eager to be manipulated, explaining why there is no dissension in the ranks? Or is there something sinister in Polonius's look that speaks to some threat made on the king's behalf? Notable cuts, the Norway subplot is absent from the film, so there's no need for Cornelius or Voltemand. This was expected. And then there's a missing line, however. In this version, Claudius does not thank the court for having freely gone with the affair. This might indicate that the court was threatened in some way. It has not freely sided with Claudius. This makes him one of the more villainous Claudiuses. Then a change of venue. Zeffirelli has Laertes' wish to leave Denmark take place in a whole other scene. Time has obviously passed, drawing out how long Hamlet remains in his melancholy state, but also making Laertes a bit less eager to go. In the play as written, Laertes witnesses the wedding and immediately wants to return to France, speaking to the ambiguous relationship with the king revealed in the BBC staging. But this encounter happens behind closed doors, not in public. So arguably, nothing is modified for appearances. And since Hamlet isn't there, it's also not a slap in the face, either public or private. Alan Bates' Claudius isn't villainous in this scene, so I'll admit to not liking his Claudius, which, in large part due to the cuts, is rather two-dimensional. But if there's a scene that redeems him for me, it is this one. Here he is affable, he's warm, he's full of good humor. If it were not for the creepy stare and delivery in the movie's first scene, we would not understand Hamlet's reaction. Perhaps Claudius is simply good-humored because he's basking in his victory. Ask me anything, for I can do anything. But I think it's absolutely correct to portray Claudius as being more familial with Polonius's family than he is with his own. Nathaniel Parker's Laertes, for his part, is a fresh-faced, almost naive youth, another one, awed by power and reverent. We do not feel any fear in his demeanor, in this case, and his character is generally lighter than some other performances. Notable cuts from this section, you cannot speak of reason to the Dane and lose your voice, this line, had several functions. First, it reveals Claudius's pragmatism, or the image he has of himself as a pragmatist, the clockwork logic that led to his fratricide, and something that will inform his ploys at the end of the play. Now, second, it has an ironic undertone. What is reasonable in this disjointed state? These nuances are lost, but they don't affect our understanding of the play. Claudius also fails to say that the head is more native to the heart than is the throne of Denmark to thy father, downplaying his connection with Polonius and Polonius's role in his political rise to power. And finally, Laertes does not consider Claudius a dread lord, but more importantly, omits the words, "that duty done." So he doesn't imply he had to come to the wedding. Like I said, this Laertes is not afraid of the king and even has warm feelings towards his sort of kindly uncle. We can again look at Laertes and Hamlet as brothers. The overall effect of Laertes' demeanor in this scene is to hide Claudius' villainy. Is Zeffirelli trying to play it as a reveal for audiences that do not know the story? Possible, since this was a high-profile Mel Gibson project, possibly meant as larger audiences' first Hamlet. Another 10 years. In Hamlet 2000, the modern retelling, the banquet is a press conference, which makes perfect sense for the adaptation. The new CEO/king announces publicly to the world, via the press, not the court, how he has stabilized the company, Denmark, and how he's not afraid of a hostile takeover by Fortinbras. In this way, the company is a warlike state. Claudius is played by Kyle MacLachlan, who is convincing as a charismatic but tough corporate maneuverer. He and Diane Venora as Gertrude appear as a younger than expected power couple. Their apparent youth and sexiness is a sign of the times. In the 2000s, people tend to look younger than previous generations tended to at the same age, or at least strive to. This is important because it really puts the lie to Hamlet's later contention that at your age, the blood is tame. Difficult to agree with that sentiment when the two are still quite vital and openly lustful with each other. One bit of reattributed dialogue.
For all.
Our thanks.
As you can hear, the line is divided down the middle. This is clearly staged by the characters. It's an organized event, after all. But it's a clear symbol of their joining. Man and wife are one flesh, drawing her into Claudius's culpability through that association. Claudius holds up a newspaper with Fortinbras' picture on it. In this modern world, pestering with message is done a lot more publicly, which can be said to have an effect on the scene. In a traditional staging, Claudius chooses to tell the world about Fortinbras' message, whereas here, he's forced to by the media. But in both cases, he uses it as an opportunity to show off, with more bluster than substance. The difference is that this Claudius is perhaps not as calculated as the medieval one. Better at improvising, maybe? Dangerous when cornered? Well, we'll see. While the scene is replete with extra stage directions for the non-speaking characters, which I'll get to in a moment, Claudius at least can rip the paper he traditionally has to in other stagings. It's a newspaper. But no Voltaman nor Cornelius to send another message. They are scarcely needed, since the corporate adversaries are speaking through the press. It would have been cool if the newspapers of record were called the Voltaman and the Cornelius, but no one thought of it. The camera looks around the room. Hamlet is visible in this scene even before Claudius and Gertrude. He's filming the event for use in his video soliloquies, and this will pay off later. He appears bored and disconnected from the proceedings, with dark glasses hiding his eyes, possibly all part of holding his tongue in deference to his mother. We also get a good look at the Polonius family. Bill Murray provides one of my favorite takes on Polonius here, already noticing shenanigans between Ophelia and Hamlet, setting up the next scene. Ophelia is played by the, at the time, ubiquitous Julia Stiles, who keeps looking over to Hamlet, trying to get his attention. Liv Schreiber is Laertes, either aloof, he can't wait to get back to France, this may be one of those Laertes who doesn't care for the new king, or simply distracted as he too notices what passes between his sister and Hamlet. This is a problem very much on the family's collective mind. Also note the ghost of Hamlet Sr. hovering above them in the background, but as a painting, not as an actor. Through the use of extra stage directions for Ophelia, the film manages to juxtapose certain characters in a new and meaningful way. For example, on With an Auspicious and Dropping Eye, on that line, we see Ophelia's own hopeful eye drop down as Hamlet ignores her. A clever subtext to the line, but also one that links Ophelia Hamlet to Gertrude Claudius. If there is a relation standing in the way of Ophelia being with the man she loves, the same could be true of Gertrude if indeed she was having an affair with Claudius. Her Laertes was Hamlet Sr. himself. Like Laertes, Hamlet Sr. is also a character that is said to be away much of the time and good at warlike matters. So we're used to comparing Laertes with Hamlet Jr., but with Sr. as well, it's intriguing. Laertes, as a young Hamlet Sr., further accentuates the brotherly link between Laertes and Hamlet Jr. and his treatment as an alternative son at the hands of Claudius, the faux Hamlet Sr. You may have to rewind and listen to that sentence a couple times again. The mirroring almost needs a diagram to grasp completely. Another juxtaposition between dialogue and visuals. As Claudius talks about being pestered by message, we see Ophelia frenetically trying to arrange a meeting with Hamlet by not really writing, but drawing a note. They make her a visual artist in this. It is intercepted by Laertes, not that Hamlet reaches out for it at all. Though Ophelia is the messenger here, we're reminded that Hamlet also used to write her, she has a lot of correspondence, pun not intended, to redeliver later. The correspondence created here is then between Hamlet and Fortinbras, two sides of the same coin, heirs apparent with opposite methods. Like Fortinbras, Hamlet is pestered by message. The sequence made me realize that there is a theme of messages falling on deaf ears or being intercepted throughout the play. Polonius intercepts a letter from Hamlet, and later Ophelia returns his letters. Fortinbras' message is ripped up, and later his answer to Claudius' emissaries turns out to be a lie and tactic. Rosencrantz and Guildenstern's message to England is subverted. Claudius' prayers do not rise up to heaven. Should we also see here the ghost's message not getting through to Hamlet? After the high of the press conference, we have a separate scene with just the immediate families. There's dancing and kissing between the newlyweds, and Claudius overlooks Hamlet completely in favor of Laertes. Laertes is surprised, but unlike the BBC version, in which he seems to think Claudius is subverting the natural order of things, this Laertes is distracted by whatever is going on between Hamlet and his sister. We see him finding his way to her side and bringing her back and away from the prince in between lines. There can only be two reasons for this in a modern context. Either he loves his sister unnaturally and is therefore jealous, or he dislikes Hamlet for some reason, motivating the later scene where he tells his sister not to see him again. Or it could be both. We'll see as the film progresses, right? Ophelia, for her part, is showing rebellious tendencies, usually not afforded her character, in more traditional stagings, but that make complete sense in a modern context. It's something that will color her lines throughout the play. The scene ends oddly, with Claudius pushing Hamlet away. It really looks like something was edited out here. And he'll not address his nephew until later, when they are out in the street after the event. Now, Fodor, for his 2007 experimental version, intercuts various parts of scene 2 and scene 3 as if occurring more or less simultaneously at the banquet. Here, it's a cocktail party or reception. Claudius is making his speech in one part of the room, while Horatio is telling Hamlet about seeing the ghost in another. And Ophelia and Polonia, here Ophelia and Laertes' older sister, give their goodbyes to Laertes near the window. I'll still deal with each part individually in the proper episode. The scene, or the film, really, opens with the title card, "No More But So," which is a line from scene 3, intercut with Claudius' speech. The line has Ophelia acquiesce to her domineering brother's wishes. And there's a fatalism about it that doesn't always register, but by placing it at the top of the play, even if it weren't after a prologue that shows Ophelia's death, it takes on the greater fatalism of the entire play. "This and nothing else" is a line that underscores a pervading sense of doom, a sense that there's no changing destiny. Notable, since Claudius has just usurped a brother's destiny, or a nephew's. I spoke last time of Fodor's myriad devices in the credit sequence, which included line readings, outtakes, and dramatis personae. Well, add to that a stylish but ultimately irrelevant device to introduce the characters in the extended banquet sequence. Each time we meet a character, there is a freeze frame and an overlay that says something like Claudius, White King, and Gertrude, White Queen. I'll mention the others as they come up. Characters are divided into two colors, white, which is the Hamlet family, and red, the Polonius family, and into chess pieces, king, queen, knight, and pawn. As to why? There is no chess motif in the rest of the film, nor does Fodor keep up the visual style. The effect is to oppose the two sides of the board, with the reds being against the whites, which isn't strictly true. I think it's interesting to see Polonia, as moving against or manipulating Claudius for her own personal gain, quite believable from the utterly corrupt Polonia of the film, using other family members in various ways against Hamlet, and in some sense against Claudius too. Moving against Hamlet pushes the prince ever closer to killing Claudius, and gives the king impetus to trust Polonius ever more. However, it falls apart when you examine the white side, since Hamlet and Horatio are not on Claudius's side. Which piece is assigned to which character is also of note, but again, I'll talk about each when it comes up in a scene. Claudius and Gertrude are, of course, king and queen, nothing surprising there. Weaving in and out of various scenes within the same party reduces Claudius's initial power considerably. There's a lot of noise in the room, both from the driving electric guitar music and various groups of people enjoying themselves or not. Claudius doesn't address the entire court, just a couple of people he's mingling with, and from a speech designed to manipulate public opinion, his lines become anecdotes. How he came to marry Gertrude, how he got a message from Fortinbras, and the sound drops in and out as we move about the space. It's like it's just an overheard conversation, but maybe because we hear it through Ophelia's or Hamlet's ears? I don't know. Claudius doesn't think an assembly, politics seem less important, so it's probably appropriate since this dreamlike Denmark never quite seems like a country. Completely cut from this part of scene 2 is Laertes asking leave of Claudius. More expectedly, Voltemann and Cornelius don't make the cut, nor does the vast majority of the speech about Fortinbras. Again, Claudius's royal power is undercut. In this version, Denmark may just be two intertwined important families, red and white, of which Claudius is the main patriarch. It was perhaps important then to change Polonius's gender so as to remove a red patriarch. Fodor eliminates the political and regal elements, bringing the play down to its basic family drama. The father and mother are the king and queen of a family, and Fodor's experiment here may show the state is not required to make Hamlet work, though it does reduce the overall tone from epic to banal, courtly pageantry to tacky cocktail party. 2009, the so-called Tenant adaptation imports the mirrored floor from the stage version to the film location. It finds its way here in a room that will serve many purposes throughout the film. Here it is the banquet hall, but it'll soon be where Hamlet talks to the ghost, the throne room, and other redressed spaces. Again, the mirroring in the play is highlighted by the design choice, and is also found in the casting. Though in the theater, we're used to actors doubling up on small roles, the film version retains the stage play's casting. The players, Rosencrantz and Guildenstern, Osric, etc., all have dual roles, even if you don't necessarily notice, as when they play lords in attendance. Much more noticeable, and an example of true mirroring, is Patrick Stewart playing both the ghost and Claudius, two brothers more alike than Hamlet would have us believe, and yet different in personality. Stewart's second crack at the role, the BBC's 1980 version being the other one, is a much more interesting and mature take on the character. The first disappointed me, but this one is among my favorite interpretations. As he begins his coronation wedding speech, he hypocritically chokes back a tear, his voice cracking as he talks about his brother.
Though yet of Hamlet, our dear brother's death, the memory be green.
Soon enough, however, he's making jokes. In this performance, Claudius is well aware of the ironies of his lines and uses them to make his audience chuckle.
With mirth in funeral and with dirge in marriage.
Crazy old world, isn't it? Stewart exudes charm, though to Hamlet, it must register as callousness. We see the young prince here reacting to the whole situation, glum, eyes in his champagne glass. Gertrude is sometimes distracted by his attitude, but mostly she hangs on Claudius's words. Though Fortinbras won't appear at the end of this version, he is still a talking point. Cornelia, a female Cornelius, and Voltemand are present and being sent to Norway to broker a peace. Something mentioned by the director in the DVD extras worth mentioning is that Claudius's first act as king is one of diplomacy. Hamlet Sr., we'll remember from the previous scene, was a warrior. Though we cannot endure fratricide, we can still ask the question, was Claudius's coup, motivated by lust and power though it was, a necessary evil for the Kingdom of Denmark? Did he in fact depose a dangerous warmonger? And is he not advocating a gentler, more positive role for Denmark in Europe? We can ask, But Shakespeare's answer is to have Denmark invaded by Fortinbras at the end of the play. Diplomacy does not work in this world, and war is the proper way to go. Then again, it may be a question of the ends not justifying the means. Karmically, Claudius's sin cannot bring about a positive change. He can only harvest corrupted fruit from his unweeded garden. After dealing with affairs of state, he turns to Hamlet, and now? But turns on his heel. Laertes! Stewart pulled a similar fake-out in 1980, but here makes it an even more shocking slight. Laertes, played by Edward Bennett, who was also Tennant's understudy and had to take on the role on stage for a number of weeks when Tennant hurt his back, is intimidated despite the king's jollity. More than taken unawares, it seems like he was thinking of not even asking the king's leave at all. Oliver Ford Davies' wonderful Polonius mouths the words with him. It's all been practiced, and we definitely get the sense that Polonius' children are sheltered. Polonius takes care of every facet of their lives, and one might imagine a different Claudius acting surprised that his advisor would let his son out of his sight when he asks, "Have you your father's leave? What says Polonius?" Even the king defers to Polonius on matters regarding the children, the adult children. On the play within a play side of things, no bleak midwinter bit, but Slings and Arrows is rather playful with the banquet scene, using our knowledge of the actors' stories to give each scene an extra level, one that actually manages to comment on the play. The Claudius of this play is also known as Alan, and is not really a character in the series. Once he gets going, we cut to Cyril and Frank watching the performance on closed circuit backstage and saying how he's got a good voice tonight. Cyril notes that it's really all he's got. A perfect moment for these guys who regularly act as a comic chorus, as if on the balcony at the Muppet Show. But they also poke fun at Claudius as a character. Claudius is an arrogant blowhard full of hot air and no substance, contrasting with the quiet and sensitive Hamlet. We can also note how Hamlet is right at the front of the stage in this moment. While we don't see most of the scene, the editing basically cuts from the first speech to Claudius's exit, we can imagine Claudius going through the motions and addressing everyone in turn, very much ignoring the elephant in the room. When you reveal that Hamlet was there all along and finally draw him out, the audience might be right to think Claudius was perhaps forgetting him. When he's in full view like this, Claudius is actively ignoring him and prioritizing other characters over him. During the initial speech, there's a nice bit of double acting from Gertrude, as played by Ellen Fanshawe, herself played by Martha Burns. Jack Crew, played by Luke Kirby, is deathly afraid of being shown a fool. He's the action movie teen heartthrob cast as Hamlet, and is just keeping from throwing up. Ellen Gertrude looks down on him with a look of sudden concern. The actress wonders if this will turn out to be a disaster, as she predicted, but the character seems to register something amiss with her son, motivating the interrogation comforting to come. Works perfectly in the series, where "use it" is often advised in response to something that should distract the actor, just as Jack is using his nausea in the scene. Classics Illustrated, well, as previously stated, the wedding banquet does not appear in the original adaptation, whose focus is on boys' own adventures. A wedding would seem to go against that. The adaptation leaves Laertes' introduction to scene 3, which already covers his leaving for France, as a plot point. Tom Mandrake's adaptation, however, cuts very little from this section of the play, keeping the rant about Fortinbras' ambitions, though predictably cutting the appearance of Voltamand and Cornelius. Introducing characters requires panels, and the comic's relatively low page count often requires it to do entire speeches in one panel. The problem with this is that the artist cannot change the character's emotion mid-speech, and things play out all the more flatly in static shots. For example, in this instance, though Claudius says of Fortinbras, "so much for him," there is no accompanying action. It's like the character is just dismissing Fortinbras out of hand, which I suppose he does, but not even with the proper physical punctuation to get the crowd's response. Also cut is Claudius's thanks to the court for going along with this royal wedding. Mandrake's Laertes is timid when begging Claudius, in line with performances that play on the line "Dread Lord." Comics tend to physically caricature the characters, so Claudius is something of a rough sort, and Laertes wise to be afraid of him. By contrast, Polonius is drawn as a kindly old man, creating an unshakable sympathy for the character that makes his death seem undeserved. I prefer my Polonius with a dark streak, as mandated by the full text. The overall effect here is that Claudius is a bully, and that despite his honeyed words, he's just using Polonius and Gertrude for political gain. Generally, I'm afraid the images lack the subtlety to really carry the play's truths, and the gap between words and action is a harsh one. Well, that was Act 1, Scene 2, Part 1. Next time, we'll finally meet the Prince of Denmark in a section I call Enter Hamlet. If you have thoughts on this particular episode, please head over to fireandwaterpodcast.com and put keyboard to digital paper. Now, I don't have feedback from the previous episode yet, because I've been taping these a bit in advance to make the schedule. But I think maybe at the end of every act or the start of the next act would be a good time to cover all the feedback we've gotten on the previous act. I might be able to do it a little sooner than that. We'll see how it goes. I remind you that if you like this content, think about visiting our Patreon page at patreon.com/FW podcast. So thanks for listening, and I hope you, dear listener, will return for the second part of Act 1, Scene 2.
Is silence.